design a house, carve stone with a chainsaw, build a life-size human ceramic, work in graphic design with no pretense about a glass ceiling. Come meet today's guest. Welcome. You have tuned in to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio. KCBX serves the beautiful California Central Coast from Salinas to Ventura. Co-host Krista Hewitt and I traveled to the lovely village of Cambria to visit with sculptor Lucy Ryan. Lucy is one of the movers and shakers behind the upcoming California Sculpture Slam to be held at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art, opening at the end of September. More about that in next week's program. Today, we hear of Lucy's artistic journey in her own words.
Stephen and I are up here in Cambria with Lucy Ryan. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hello, Lucy.
We're sitting in your studio at the moment, and we've just had a brief tour of your wonderful house, which it sounds as though you actually designed it.
Well, I had a big part in the design of the house. We did have an architect and a builder, but I had plans drawn before we even met them. We had bought the lot, and I sat and taught myself how to draw the plans and figured out what I wanted.
How many years ago was that?
The house was finished 12 years ago. We moved in permanently 10 years ago. And soon we'll be moving to New Zealand.
Okay, that's a little shift.
Never mind.
What part of New Zealand?
Probably Nelson.
Oh, I love that area.
And I'm interested in Nelson because it's kind of arty, and it's
very
not
arts and crafty,
heavy,
yeah,
into a big city.
Right.
Sort of the size of San Luis. Mm-hmm.
After I retired in 07, I did my second remodel and found that I was just so immersed in making decisions all the time. Were you finding, or is this just such an obvious question that doesn't have to be asked, that your three-dimensional and full art-on background was playing a real role in how you saw things?
Absolutely. Just the way I envisioned the levels of the house is really a shoebox, but when you're in it, you can't find your way around so easily because there's only one square room in the house, and that's the downstairs bathroom. So that makes it more interesting to live in. Also, what the views were going to be and how much light you could have. You want to have light coming in from the ceiling in certain places in the house because there's no window light. But anyway, it was fun to do, and I really relished making all the decisions, right down to the doorknobs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. That's the detail, and that's the kind of thing that says, this is my house versus everybody else's.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You did some remodeling, too.
Yeah, 8 years ago, we completely gutted our house and added a back room and completely redid it.
Was it fun?
No, because we lived in it at the time.
Oh, and that was... Oh, well, no, I have done that. I renovated a Victorian in San Francisco, mm-hmm, that I was living in at the time, and it was tough.
It was very tough, yeah. As I told my husband, I said, if we ever do this again, I'm going away for 6 months, and you take care of it.
So this adventure came a little bit later. Where did art start for you?
I was born with a desire to make art. I was drawing and painting and making doll clothing and all kinds of things from the time I was a child. My mother recognized that. She sent me for art lessons pretty early on because I went to a school that did not teach art in school. And then, of course, when it came to going to college, I went 2 years to college and a couple of years to Parsons School of Design in Manhattan, and then I got my degree from Hunter College in Studio Arts.
Did you grow up in New York?
I grew up in Westchester, New York, and then I lived in Midtown Manhattan for 5 years before coming to California. That was probably one of the most exciting times of a young person's life, to live in Manhattan and have access to all the culture there.
I bet.
What brought you to California?
Well, I was married at the time to an architect, and we both had an interest in California, and we decided to drive out here one summer when they never paid him overtime, he only got comp time, so we had like 3 months. And we bought a station wagon and filled the back up with a big can of oatmeal cookies and drove across country. and slept in the car. And then we headed up to Seattle. We went to Glacier and Seattle and down the coast. And finally we hit California. And San Francisco was a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. It was only a question of whether we were going to live in town or live in Marin County. And we ended up in Marin County for 5 years. And then I moved into town when that broke up. And I lived in North Beach and also in the Mission for, I don't know, 30 years.
In terms of your art, currently a good part of it now is as a sculptor. But I'm understanding there was a lot of other along the way or still.
Well, I think I always related better to three-dimensional things. Even, you know, in art school, I did better when in the metal shop or life drawing figures in big for me because I'm a figurative artist. But I really love making things of all kinds and three dimensions. So I think I appreciate three-dimensional art better than I appreciate two-dimensional art.
You carve stone, but mostly you're doing clay?
Mostly I do ceramics. About half life-size or near life-size figures. They're stylized. They are recognizable as figures. They're not abstract, but they do have a special style. That's about it. I have started stone carving a number of times. I have all the tools. I have a pile of stones on the terrace. And I like working in stone, but whenever I'm working in stone, I'm missing working in clay. And they're total opposite things to do. It's really good to work in both because it really trains your ability to see the form one way or the other. As you know, clay is very plastic. You can, if you make mistakes, especially with the clay I use, you can fix them. With stone, well, you can actually add stone to stone. I know an artist who her whole work is adding stone together, but basically it's a subtractive medium, and it's very interesting to study both.
How do you find that kind of playing out in terms of what one sort of teaches you about the other as you're developing form?
As little I've done in stone, it teaches me to visualize in a different way than I do with clay. When I make these larger clay figures, I make a maquette. It's not a very detailed one, and it doesn't always look that, like that when it comes out, but I kind of have to know where I'm going because I'm building with coils and I'm building a structure while I'm designing the piece. It has to support itself. For instance, that piece there, I have a technique of being able to build up and let it dry enough to support the next level, whereas with stone, the direct carving method is what I have studied with John Fisher and with some other people. And basically, you look at the stone and you start whacking it off and it somehow comes to you what you're going to do.
I work that way as well. But my work is non-objective. So I'm sitting there saying, oh, I kind of like the movement that's here. I'm just going to keep pursuing this. And you've got a different agenda going. So there's a little less ability to say, oh, the nose just fell off. Okay, we're going to shift.
Well, one of the things that I learned in learning stone is you can always go deeper. And instead of staying out there on the surface and being afraid to dig in, it's better to go deeper, and you can make the whole thing smaller if you have to, but you need to get into it. When you're beginning stone carving, it's just a matter of taking a big stone and making a pile of rubble out of it on the ground. I mean, you just have to learn to do that. I took a course with Candace Garrett in Taos, New Mexico. That was a course in learning, and it turned out to be all women, power tools. So this is another approach to stone carving where she had a chainsaw and you had to put a big apron on because water was everywhere and the chainsaw was about as long as my leg. And here I am, you know, holding this chainsaw. And then we did all the other power tools, the grinders and the air tools and all of that. And of course, hand carving is really kind of the most peaceful way to carve. That other stuff, it's so intense with all the noise and all the pressure and all the vibrations. But any of that is good for me. Candace is the one who puts stones together. She attaches them with metal rods and builds big things out of smaller stones. Anyway, I think stone carving is really exciting, and I expect I will get more into it as long as my body holds out.
I was thinking right to that point. I mean, it's exciting, it's challenging, but there are limitations for a lot of us in terms of, okay, now I've got 300 pounds of stuff sitting here. which isn't very much in terms of volume, and I need to turn it over.
It's something that painters don't think of a lot of the times, because when you're working with stone and metal and things like that, there is an absolute physical limitation that's placed upon you. I mean, you can throw big canvases around like crazy, but it's physically, I don't want to say damaging, but it's physically...
Well, it is damaging.
Yeah, it can be. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I had a friend of mine who's a metal sculptor, and he just got up one day and he says, I can't do this anymore. I'm too old. It's taking too big of a toll on my body. And he just stopped.
Well, I know several stone carvers who mostly lost their hearing. Mm-hmm. I do know a lady who's much more frail than I am, and I suspect older, who has a big engine lift in her backyard, and she carves thousands of pounds of stone, and she just manages it with the lift equipment, and that's probably where I'd have to go.
Yes, I have an engine hoist, but moving the engine hoist, you know, a little pebble, a little something that just... I have others around when I'm doing that, but boy, without that, I wouldn't get very far at all.
If you have just joined us, you are listening to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly interview program focusing on the visual arts. Ears on Art is produced at listener-supported public radio KCBX in San Luis Obispo on the Central California coast. Today's guest is Lucy Ryan, a sculptor residing in Cambria, who now explains the process of building large ceramic human figures by the coil pot method.
I'm going to backtrack just a bit. You talked about using coils, and I know what those are, but I'm not sure we've really explained that process in clay.
Using coils means taking your fresh clay that's wedged and rolling it into big, long snakes and curling it layer over layer and attaching the layers with a tool or with your hand to get a whole surface. And you really do have to know what direction you're going in when you're doing that, and you have to have something in mind. It's not like you can just do it and then find out what it does later. And it's structurally difficult to do on a big piece, because at some point, and it's happened to me, you put too many layers of coils on and they just collapse because they aren't sturdy enough to hold themselves up. I use a clay called paper clay. It's a sculptural mix. It has a lot of what they call grog in it, which is similar to sand, only it's ground up clay. And it has fibers in it, cellulose fibers. And the cellulose fibers help it to be much stronger in the drying stages. In fact, I have had to use a saw to cut through a leather hard or a dry piece to change it. But it does allow you to do some patching at the end. If you want to add some clay, you can wet your almost dry piece and still add more clay onto it. The piece that I'm working on now is a torso, and as you can see, I've built it up to the shoulders. I have to still put the head and arms and a leg on it, but a torso has to be firm enough that I can depend on it, that when I'm whacking around the clay on the arms and the legs and so forth, that the torso isn't going to crack or collapse.
That is very definitely one of the things with clay that I experienced enough to let me know that it was frustrating for me. Gravity is gravity, and to pretend that it's a law that we can just dismiss is only to our detriment. So as you say, you get the piece up, and I mean, it's a hollow structure.
Yes, it's like an upside-down pot. Mm-hmm.
Right. With the piece that we're looking at over here, there's quite a bit of diagonal movement as she's sitting, leaning forward, so you've got the back going up at almost a 45. You've got to make sure it's not going to fall over. I'm intrigued when you're saying that you can add when it's almost dry, because regular clay you can't do that with. And the reason is that clay shrinks. At least most clays have a pretty good amount of shrinkage. So it's already changed its dimension more than the new clay that you put on. And they're going to do that at different rates, and they don't like each other. So this other clay doesn't have much shrinking?
It doesn't shrink as much because it's a sculpture mix, which means that it's got so much grog in it that there's less shrinkage. But it's really the action of the cellulose fibers, which transfer the moisture from the wet clay to the drier clay and help it to stick. You have to know what you're doing in terms of, are you going to build this arm a little bit beefier because the torso's already shrunk 3% or 4%? It doesn't shrink that much. It gets really firm, and I keep it covered so that it doesn't shrink so much that I can't attach. But that is an advantage to that clay.
And it's a pale gray in color? Is that the only way it comes?
Or? Unfortunately, it fires to yellow, a yellowish color, which I usually try to put a slip or an ongo of a color over the clay so that it's not, that I'm not always fighting that yellow color because I don't really particularly like it. But I could use it.
And does it go through a bisque or a partial fire, or do you take it all the way in one shot?
If I'm intending to put glaze on it, which I have started to do, the new adventure is now how do I get color with... Most of my pieces are all one color. The new adventure is putting color. I made a piece, which I don't have here, that I glazed, and I really like it, and the person who bought it really likes it. So I'm thinking to go that way. And in that case, I would bisque fire it. Otherwise, we do a one long firing. I usually, do you know what candling is? That means putting in the kiln at 200. I usually will do that to drive out the final moisture for about, say, 2 nights. Not continuously, but 2 nights at night. And then I start a firing on, say, Friday night or Thursday night, and it'll go through the weekend. It's a very long firing. And I have a program on the computer that takes care of that. The kiln is monitored so that the bottom and the top of the kiln are always within a degree or two of each other. So I don't have to fight the cold bottom or cold top of the kiln. That's why I got, it's a very specialized kiln.
I hadn't seen one like it. If you imagine a box that has a lid that goes all the way down over the top, and you're raising this up,
Yes. And
then you can put the pieces in from any side you want, and then lower the top back down. It seems very ingenious in terms of kill loading and kill emptying. So
it's called a bell kiln, and the basically walls of the kiln and the top of the kiln are on a winch, and my husband electrified it, so I didn't have to turn a wheel. There's a lock position to keep it up, so you have to have enough clearance to in your ceiling to have the top of the kiln go all the way up. And I could sit in that kiln. It's that big, although I don't want to. I have nightmares about sitting in there and having somebody put the thing down.
This goes back again to being very much the designer of the house, that you knew what those specs were going to be.
Yes, before I moved down here, I rented a studio space in a place called The Clay Place. I was working full-time, and so the only time I could work there were nights and weekends. But I did learn what I needed to learn about what equipment I would need to pull this forward. I really have an ambition to make larger-than-life-size pieces. If you might have noticed when you pulled up, there's two standing pieces outside. Mm-hmm. Those were an experiment, and if I had to make a piece in sections, that I could, because I haven't been able to manage a standing piece all in one piece. The legs of the piece just don't hold up the torso, at least not yet. The other big issue is a full-size human piece would be too heavy for me to manage.
Mm-hmm. Well, that certainly makes sense. And we think of clay as being this collapsible material, but many of us have seen large figurative marble sculptures, and they all have tree trunks and stuff around the base holding up somebody because they can't stand on their legs either. Mm-hmm. David would crack and fall apart.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that those aren't just design elements that they've thrown in there. They're actual structural problems that are being solved.
And then you see some people who get it so thin and so, delicate, you just stand there and kind of gaze at it and go, how did you do this? So... Okay, we got you into sculpture, both from clay and from stone, but you were telling me the other day that you've done quite a bit of graphic design. That seems like a whole shift from what we've just been talking about. Yes?
Well,
no?
Yes, well, when I was at Parsons School of Design, what I was studying was graphic design. So from there, I actually did graphic design for a number of years in New York. I did not work in an ad agency, and it was Mad Men time. It really was that time that was exactly like the way they portray it. And actually, when I was in school, they brought guys in from the ad agency who would go so far as to stand up in front of us and tell us, well, all you women in this class don't expect to ever get anywhere in our business. We don't promote women in the ad agencies. You can be a secretary or, a receptionist, and maybe you'll get to do some board work. I mean, it was right out in the open. we're not going to do it. So I basically worked for a private company for a number of years, and I wasn't really doing high-end graphic design. It was more like illustration. But it does affect my work, because I do see things in volumes maybe differently than somebody who's looking at a life model. I mean, I do work from life models, and one of the things I really value is having a model that'll stay in the same pose for, say, 4 hours, you know, mm-hmm. a break every 10 minutes or 20 minutes, and you don't get that in the normal life drawing kind of class. So that's something that I pursue when I can get at it. And I don't consider those pieces. I consider those studies or possibly maquettes, but they aren't really what my end up work is.
And in the world of graphic design, you're working for a client. In the world of sculpture, you have the option of perhaps always thinking that you need a client, but don't have to have one to go out and do the work. How does that affect either side of that equation?
Well, I think commercial art, whether it's graphic design or technical writing or architecture, you're really balancing the needs of either the community or the client or the business against your taste. And I'm sure that anybody who's ever worked in any of those fields knows the frustration of having your client tell you what to do. Mm-hmm. That's very nice. I mean, it's a beautiful design, but I want it this way. Mm-hmm. If you're making a living, you have to balance that. I've produced a lot of printing jobs in conjunction with graphic design firms, and I often have to tell the graphic designer, if you want to do it that way, you're going to make it cost 3 times more for your client than it would otherwise. It's a matter of, if it's this size paper, it has to be on this size press, that kind of thing. So there's always those considerations of how do you actually produce it, which there are the same kind of considerations. For instance, I have to decide when I'm building a piece, will it fit in my kiln? If it won't fit in my kiln, am I willing to make it in sections and things like that? But those decisions are all coming from me. Right. And so I find it's very freeing to do whatever you want to do. And of course, I did have a business for years, so I couldn't be a full-time artist until I reached a later part of my life.
Typical for a lot of us. Yeah, that's why I don't do commission works, because I don't want somebody dictating artistic decisions for me. It's like, I do enough work on my own. You can pick one of those.
I had a potential client who wanted me to do a nude sculpture of her, and I had some maquettes in here, and she picked one out that was a pose that only the very highest level professional model could possibly hold for the amount of time it would take me to get enough detail down to have the pose. Basically, she wanted to do that pose, and I said, well, I just don't think we can do that. And I had to turn her away, because you can't deal with that.
So many levels of things that just are not on the surface apparent to either the client or sometimes even the artist. I mean, they used to talk about when American Craft Council was first getting started with people selling at wholesale venues around the country. And they would get so excited because people would come in and they'd order 100 lidded pots or something. And then they had to go home and make them all and ship them and get them there on time. You know, this whole learning curve, because nobody was teaching those things in school in the late 70s and 80s. Was an eye-opener that people didn't know how to display their work for people at those kind of sales. They had to have contests so that people would make an attractive booth. I mean, there's so much that goes on kind of behind the scenes if you're really trying to make your living doing this.
Particularly with three-dimensional things, and particularly with ceramics, which are fragile. My pieces aren't very fragile because they're big, I have to build them thick, and I fire them to a level that they are not going to fall apart or if it get dinged or something. But I know people who have to haul their stuff around, and they have to have a trailer or, you know, rent a truck or whatever, and that's really hard work and labor and time. Actually, my first open studio, I sold a very large piece, and it was the first piece I'd sold. I've been doing ceramics for many years, but it was the first piece I sold, like, through an open studio. And eventually I decided, I was lucky enough to be asked to put my work in the gallery, and frankly, that's the way to go for me. I'm not really good at selling my work. I know artists that are, but I kind of clam up when they want to know, what gave you this idea? So, I mean, some people are much more outgoing in that context. I have to learn that. I really do. But in the meantime, I'd much prefer to have somebody else dealing with it.
Yes, most artists are horrible at representing themselves. They're really, really bad at it. And I think a lot of it is they simply don't like to talk about themselves. And that's required to sell your own artwork, is you have to be able to have that interpersonal connection and explain the motivations and processes and things like that. And most artists don't like doing that at all.
I think that's true. I did take a little course in, you know, how to get your art in an art gallery. And the guy who gave the course, he's written books about this, and he goes around and he tells artists in a seminar, how do you present yourself to a gallery? And it's quite rigorous. You have to be able to walk into a gallery and explain yourself in two or three sentences and hand a portfolio to someone. And, you know, it takes a lot of nerve.
It does.
And also, nowadays, you have to have a website. I mean, that's the first thing they ask you is, what's your website? And most artists don't like doing that either.
Well, luckily I have a husband who did that for me, but mine needs to be redesigned. But I went into a gallery with another artist who was a very accomplished sculptor who had a piece on display down the street from the gallery, and the owner was not interested at all in going to see the physical piece, just wanted to see what it was on the screen. In three-dimensional art, seeing the physical piece is a whole different experience than seeing a piece in two dimensions in a picture. I was kind of amazed at that.
Co-host Krista Hewitt and I have been speaking with Lucy Ryan, a large-scale ceramic figurative artist residing in the quaint village of Cambria on the northern coast of San Luis Obispo County. Lucy is also one of the driving forces behind the upcoming exhibit at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art, the California Sculpture Slam, which opens September 25th and runs until November 15th. The juror for the show is renowned artist Bella Feldman. The artist reception and awards ceremony is on Saturday, September 26th, from 3:30 until 5:30 p.m. The San Luis Obispo Museum of Art is located at the west end of Mission Plaza in downtown San Luis Obispo and is open Wednesday through Monday from 11 a.m. until 5 p.m. Admission is free. For more information, visit sloma.org. Next week, we continue our conversation with Lucy Ryan and discuss her involvement in the California Sculpture Slam. I would also like to inform our listeners that our own Krista Hewitt has an exhibit of her photographs along with poetry by Marguerite Costigan and Glenna Horton opening during Art After Dark on Friday, October 2nd, starting at 6 p.m. at the Steinberg Gallery, located at 1531 Monterey Street near the corner of California Boulevard. For more information, visit steinberggallery.com or call 805-547-0278. Steinberg is spelled Steinberg. You have been listening to Ears on Art, an interview program produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio, serving Southern Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara counties. I am Stephen DeLuque, and for co-host Krista Hewitt, we wish you a pleasant afternoon.